This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Hi, you're listening to Rabble Radio. I'm Victoria Fenner.
And I'm Megan Perry.
I was temporarily living in the United States on September 11th, 2001. I was surprised by the number of women who approached me after that difficult day and asked, "If we go to war with Iraq, can I send my kids up to live with you in Canada so they don't get drafted?" After saying yes, absolutely, I also had to say, but my country isn't the same Canada as it was in the 1960s when we welcomed war resistors from the United States. And in the years since the beginning of this century, the country that I loved for its compassion and generosity of spirit is disappearing. Lots of people are not welcome in Canada anymore. People can no longer count on finding refuge here. It's like our country now has big signs on our borders saying, "Go away, we don't want you here."
On today's show, we'll go to a rally held in Toronto on September 17th by the group No One Is Illegal. It was held to protest indefinite detentions of undocumented migrants. We'll hear a story about what it's like to live undocumented in Canada, living in fear of arrest, detention, or deportation. And finally, we're presenting an interview with Deepan Budlakoti. He was born in Canada, but the federal government has decided he isn't a Canadian and they want to take his passport. So in this episode, we're talking about how we react in Canada when the government says,
"Welcome to Canada."
Oh, but not you.
Or you.
Or you.
On September 17th, I went down to the Immigration and Refugee Headquarters on Victoria Avenue in Toronto. The event recognized the one-year anniversary of the day when 191 immigration detainees held in the Central East Correctional Centre in Lindsay began a non-cooperation protest. Since then, people across the country have joined the call to end immigration detention. Tings Chak is with the Toronto chapter of No One Is Illegal, a group that supports migrants and fights for immigration reform in Canada.
So today we're gathered outside 74 Victoria Street, which is the Immigration Refugee Board. So what we're doing is celebrating 1 year of resistance among immigration detainees. So on September 17th of last year, 2013, 191 migrants in detention in Lindsay, Ontario's maximum security prison, it's called the Central East Correctional Centre, they went on the largest known hunger strike organized by migrants. Initially, it was a three-day hunger strike protesting prison conditions, but it's grown into a large movement, as you can see, a lot of support from the public here. And the main demands have been around an end to indefinite detention. Right now in Canada, Canada's a rogue nation among, quote-unquote, Western nations. The UN released an opinion, an unprecedented opinion, 2 months ago in June, condemning Canadian practices of immigration detention. It was clearly stating that incarceration, detention, is a last resort. In Canada, it is rampant. Hundreds of people are detained at any given time, thousands every year. And under Harper, it's been over 85,000 people who have been detained without charge or trial and indefinitely.
So can you give me what's happening with the detainees who went on the hunger strike originally? What's happening with them now?
So many of them because they're in immigration detention, for their resistance, some of them were put into segregation. Some of them were definitely punished and separated for their acts of resistance. Others have continued to stage different actions. So in June, over 100 migrants in three maximum security prisons did a month-long boycott of their detention reviews. So that's their kind of farcical court-like system that they have to come across every month. And besides that, they refuse things like refusing to go down on lockdown, etc. So they've continued their resistance. Of course, many of people have also been deported. And today it's also about honoring their resistance and remembering the fact that they have been deported and we have lost members of our community.
So are they from any particular countries or across the board?
People are from lots of different countries. I will say, though, that the majority of people who are detained are, vast majority of people, are racialized peoples. We know that in the incarceration system, whether in immigration detention or otherwise, the people who are targeted and criminalized are usually poor people of color, people with precarious status, trans folks, gender nonconforming folks. So this is, and indigenous people as well. So this is part of that trend of criminalizing people, the most marginalized communities.
And can you tell me a little bit more about your group?
It's No One Is Illegal Toronto. So we're a grassroots non-funded group. So all of us work around three key areas. One is anti-detentions and deportations. We believe in the freedom of movement of people and that people should not be put into jail for simply moving to a place in search of better lives. They should definitely not be deported back to places of potential threats to their lives, but also places that they don't want to return to. We also work around getting access to services for undocumented people. So as some as people might know, Toronto was voted as a sanctuary city or solidarity city in 2013. And so that was a large ongoing campaign that No One Is Illegal was a part of in ensuring that Toronto is a little bit safer for undocumented residents. There are an estimated 200,000 to 300,000 of them who live in our city here in Greater Toronto Area. And finally, the third part of our work is that we ground our work in Indigenous solidarity or solidarity with Indigenous sovereignty movements. We as migrants firmly believe that here in Canada we've arrived in unoccupied lands where Indigenous people continue to be dispossessed of their lands and displaced. It's part of a larger global system of displacement, whether it's migrants from all parts of the world to Indigenous people here across Turtle Island.
Okay, and you are calling for specifically what?
We're calling for, the campaign is calling for an end to indefinite detention. People in Canada are held on immigration holds without trial, without charge, and with no end in sight. So we want a 90-day maximum. So if people cannot be deported within that amount of time, they should be released. But underlying our movement is just seeing an end to immigration detention, period. We don't think that jails, incarceration, should be used to enforce immigration laws at all.
That was Tings Chack, a spokesperson for the Toronto chapter of No One Is Illegal, a group founded to support justice for migrants in Canada.
Imagine what it would be like to be always looking over your shoulder, always wondering who knows you're in the country without documentation. Your kids' teachers, your employer, are they going to turn you in? Our next guest knows many people who live with that fear. Suzanne Narain is a Jane Finch community resident, and Narain works with undocumented migrants living in her neighborhood. She spoke to John Bonner, host of the Rabble Podcast Network's John Bonner's audio blog. She told him what life is like for migrants who live with the fear of arrest.
What's it like right now for people without status?
Well, I mean, it's very scary. In the past, when these things have been happening, people are known to leave the area or quit their jobs. which affects their livelihoods. I mean, a lot of immigrants in the community do come to Canada to look for a better life and are just, you know, making an honest living, working as construction workers, nannies, working in factories, just really trying to provide for their families. So now here we have people who have left their home countries, left all types of precarious situations, coming here looking for work, trying to build a stable life for themselves, and now they are being forced to either leave that job and leave their homes sometimes in order for safety, in order to find safety or to be safe.
Have you had a chance to speak to family members who've been affected by these recent events?
No, I haven't spoken to any family members who have been recently affected. However, our partners who are helping to organize this at No One Is Illegal is in close contact with a lot of the folks who have been arrested. A lot of them are from Latin American countries and are Spanish-speaking, so there's some language barriers. Some of the people who have been detained have said that, you know, papers have been given to them and they were not properly translated and were forced to sign, you know, removal papers or other type of documents which they had no real idea what was happening.
So, of course, language is a barrier then.
Absolutely.
And a lot of the people without status are in the process of applying for resident status. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, a lot of people are you know, either going through a refugee claim or trying to get status here, permanent residency. But with the changing of all types of immigration policies, this process is definitely slower and there's lots of holdbacks.
So this process of applying can take upwards of what, a year or two or more?
I think sometimes even more. And if there's any type of delays or any type of concerns or any type of things like, you know, forms that have been improperly filled out, that's another, you know, 6 months to a year.
Did it shock you to learn that this has been going on for some time, that what happened last week when 21 people were arrested and detained, that this is something that had been going on for I believe, over a year?
No, it doesn't actually surprise me at all. I mean, migrants, particularly migrants in racialized communities, have always faced a difficult time and have been under attack. I mean, my family that came here in the 80s, you know, sorry, in the 70s, experienced these types of raids living in the community as well. So, I mean, this is of no surprise, I think.
Can you describe what life was like for your parents back then?
I mean, when I did tell my mom about some of these things that were happening recently in the community, she told me back in the 80s when they were working and they were undocumented as well, that the immigration services would come to the factories and lock the doors and they would have to present documentation or come to your homes. And at that point, there weren't as many services and agencies that did provide, you know, a type of know your rights. So they didn't know what to do, and they did open the doors, and, you know, many family members were deported.
This must be have been extremely stressful. Are people suffering stress-related illness as a result of constantly looking over their shoulders?
Absolutely. It's absolutely frightening for families, especially families who have small children here and children who are born in Canada. I mean, if the parents doesn't have rights, they face or fear deportation and leaving their children here. I mean, that alone is, you know, can cause great amount of stress.
What's it like for the children and for the teenagers that are living here? Because they don't have the kind of childhood and adolescence that the majority of members of society would take for granted. I mean, are they constantly worried that immigration is going to walk in on the classroom, you know, at any time and just take them out, and always having that in the back of your mind?
Perhaps. I mean, I'm sure some kids are aware that this is happening with their families, or they may not be aware. I mean, something as simple as where are you from can become scary, I guess, for a kid whose family doesn't have rights, you know, because then they're disclosing themselves, or they have show and tell, or if their families have to come in and they don't speak English. I mean, there are so many ways in which families and children are implicated in this and can cause stress. I mean, there have been many, in the past, there have been many children who have, that weren't able to go to school because their families were afraid that if they enrolled their children in school, that there could be a chance that they may not, that they may get deported or reported. And, I mean, education is a basic right, you know, of a child. And of course, it's absolutely scary for them as well. And you see some of their basic rights being denied because of fear of being deported, or their families being deported.
Now, so you mentioned earlier that Toronto has been declared a sanctuary city, I believe now for almost a year. Is there a feeling of betrayal, the fact that they thought that they were safe and now these things are happening?
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, when you think that you can now freely work or go to school or go to the hospital and have a life here, and then all of a sudden you're being detained or you're being questioned or somebody is just coming to your car out of the blue asking you for documentation, there is, yes, I'm sure, a huge sense of betrayal. Like, who do you trust? What do you do?
So if people don't then feel comfortable, once again, accessing services that you and I might take for granted, what does that mean? What kinds of things that you and I would be able to access freely without giving it a second thought that these people now either have to think twice about or simply not access at all?
Well, definitely working is the main issue here. I mean, if you know, a lot of migrants or migrant workers are working for temp agencies that pick people up in the morning, take them to their jobs, bring them back. Now, the situation is, should I go to work today? Is me making my day's wages going to be, is going to risk my chance of being deported? If I get injured anywhere, like, could I go to the hospital? Am I going to be reported there? Like, school starting soon, should I send my kids to school? Because their teachers or the school administration definitely knows that their family is undocumented. I mean, there is so many intersections where an undocumented worker is at risk and is fearful.
And what are people's rights if they are stopped by the authorities?
So there is obviously the right to silence, where they don't have to, they have a right to not answer some of the questions that are being asked of them, such as where are they from or when they came to Canada, things of that nature. It is necessary to give a name and provide documentation if you are driving or riding a bicycle. If you are in a car, you don't necessarily have to do so, but you can also, that may also cause some problems. If somebody comes to your home, they have to have two warrants before they do enter your home or can enter your home, and the documentations need to have the person's name properly on the documentation before the door should be opened.
Suzanne, anything else you'd like to add?
I think if all people really push and pressure the provincial government in trying to make Ontario a sanctuary city, life would be much better for undocumented workers in Ontario. And I urge people to get online and sign the petition, talk to their local MPs and their MPPs and their city councillors, and see what we can do to help help our colleagues and our fellow citizens living in Ontario.
And where can they access this petition?
So they can look on the No One Is Illegal website, and they could find all of the links there.
That was Suzanne Narain, a Jane Finch community resident in Toronto, talking to John Bonner of the John Bonner audio blog. You can find more of John's audio blogs on the Rabble Podcast Network by clicking the link at rabble.ca/podcasts.
If you're born in Canada, you're automatically a Canadian citizen, right? Well, it turns out maybe not. Deepan Bud Lakoti was born in Canada. He's been issued a Canadian passport by the federal government, twice. The government of Ontario gave him an Ontario birth certificate. But the federal government now says he's not a Canadian citizen and he needs to go home. Except India, which the government says is his home, says no, he's not an Indian citizen. He was born in Canada, so he's Canadian. Deepan is still in Canada, but he's been stripped of his Canadian citizenship. So he's now stateless. He's under house arrest in his parents' home and can only go out between 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. He doesn't have health insurance anymore. He's living in limbo. Earlier this month, he lost his appeal of the government's decision to revoke his citizenship. The case hinges on the question, were his parents employees of the India High Commission when he was born? Deepan and his lawyers say no. Dan Keller of the Rabble Podcast Network's AWOL podcast spoke to Deepan Bud Lakoti earlier this month, a few days after he received the news of his lost appeal.
I went to court on June 16th, I believe it was June 16th, and now I got my decision on September 10th, and it was a negative decision. Decision saying that federal court does not believe that I'm stateless and does not believe that I am a citizen, registered by birth. In their federal court decision, I quote, he says, India has denied the application is a citizen of India or entitled to citizenship, but the record of this issue is sketchy at best. This is one of the quotes that is out of the federal court, his decision, essentially. He acknowledges the fact that I have a Canadian passport and birth certificate, but he says, oh, it's not the government's problem, and he believes that no charter violation has even occurred. So all charter matters, essentially, were dismissed.
How can a judge take these actions, you know, rendering you stateless while acknowledging you were born here?
Well, in my personal opinion, I believe that he had marching orders, right? Because it's common sense. Someone was born here, lived his whole life, got a Canadian passport, got a birth certificate, then 21 years later, oh, he's no longer a citizen? It's ridiculous in itself. But he clearly states that I'm not a citizen, and he's saying that he has no purview over this matter. Basically, he's saying that he's not able to do anything because doesn't fall under any violation of the charter. So, even though I provided documents clearly stating that my parents did not work for the High Commission, a letter from the former High Commission, actually the former High Commission even testified, clearly stating that my parents did not work for him. But yet, the government says, this judge specifically says that these two statements are not credible, essentially. And he's saying that, oh, he's missing a page out of one statement. So therefore, that one page is missing, apparently, in his the way that he explains in his decision, and therefore not credible.
What does this mean for you, I guess, as a as someone who has lived here in Canada all his life?
Well, it's a broader picture, really. So it just, well, in terms of two ways. One is it saying that Canada does not care about human rights and doesn't want to uphold the law, and it chooses what it wants to uphold. Two, that it's in direct violation of the charter as well as international law, and it puts me in a situation where I'm in legal limbo. I am stateless in the country that I'm born in, but yet I don't have all the rights that any other citizen would have. But, I quote, I had all the rights for 21 years until they decided that I no longer have the rights. Without even due for a process. It was just stripped away without even going to a judge or any kind of official.
And is the Harper government taking further action to exile you from Canada somehow, or?
Well, at this point, I'm on conditions. Being on conditions indefinitely, so it's a violation of the Charter of Rights, indefinite detention. Now, they have not come up with any other position, the fact that other than that I'm stateless in Canada, it has nothing that's moving forward. The government's position essentially is that I'm stateless, but yet they're not going to rectify it, and they're perfectly fine with leaving me stateless. They're basically trying to exile me from my birth country to an absolute nowhere where I cannot be deported nowhere. And the fact that we're on Indigenous land, unceded territory in Ottawa, is a whole other aspect of it as well.
So this is pretty, I mean, this seems pretty precedent-setting in terms of court decisions.
It is precedent-setting in multiple ways. One is the fact that he's acknowledging the fact that Canada now can't take away people's citizenship, even though they're born in Canada. This is what the federal court has done. Another question now is comes that it's going to make it much harder for individuals to appeal that they're dealing with immigration, based on the fact that, hey, someone born in Canada is facing deportation, but has now been rendered stateless.
Yeah, this could have pretty wide-ranging implications. Are you going to be appealing?
I'm definitely going to be appealing, yeah. I have to appeal within 30 days. There's no seek to appeal. It's a right to appeal automatically. And from there, we'll see what happens.
You've had a support campaign going around your case for quite a while. What has the Justice for DePayne support campaign been up to recently? I saw that you were at the People Social Forum.
Yeah, the People Social Forum, we had a panel, and then we also had a video screening for the Justice for DePayne documentary. Just trying to get more awareness, more public awareness on the case, and trying to bring the people's attention.
And it was a good turnout?
Yeah, it was a good turnout.
How can people support the work you're doing or your defense?
The major thing right now for me is fundraising. I need to definitely raise funds because I'll be getting billed quite a bit from the federal court for this application. And in order for me to pursue the appeal, I need to raise some serious cash.
People can go to justicefordepayne.org to find information to donate. But I also read that with being stripped of your citizenship, healthcare, work, other things that you've been able to access for, you know, the first 21 years of your life, those are now no longer accessible to you. So you need to be able to cover that kind of thing as well.
Everything, nothing was accessible to me even within the day I was being released. Nothing at all. Yeah, healthcare was up to last year, and now last year has been taken away. So I'm now challenging the healthcare aspect as well. So I have nothing. I have no social services, no healthcare, no absolutely nothing. I'm just trying to find this one document there at one point in their decision. But I want to point out where the judge dismisses one testimony, essentially, based on the fact that he claims that there's one page missing. And based on that one page missing, he does not find that statement credible. It just goes to show how far they're going with this.
And this was a page you could have replicated, gotten to him?
He received the page. He received the whole package, just with the crown as well. But saying the fact that there's a page missing, it just goes to show how undermining the system really is.
I mean, this seems to be a unilateral revocation of your citizenship. You know, would you like to comment on anything around part of a larger government project on Canadian citizenship that the Harper government seems to be working on?
Well, the Harper government's strictly attacking individuals that are based on color. Not acknowledging the fact that people have migrated to Canada to establish Canada, but now systematically targeting individuals of color from specific ethnics, and then now clearly stating that if you're born in Canada, is a new thing they're trying to pass, that you're not going to be considered citizen by birth unless your parents are both citizens. They can take away your citizenship if you get classified as a terrorist, if you get classified as a person that's doing activism, if you get classified. It just puts a difference. There's lots of ways they're doing this now, that there's four different sections what they claim that they can take away citizenship. And the evidence, their defiance of how they want to explain the person and what they can take away citizenship is very vague. What they can classify you as considered as an activist, or what they classify you as a terrorist, a domestic terrorist, what they classify you as a person that's defying the law or going against the state. There's multiple venues or various way that they want to say it, but it's so vague. So it gives a dramatic discretion to the minister. And then telling the minister that he has the right to take away citizenship without any appeal is a whole new question in itself. And then it also puts in the question, what is citizenship? Is citizenship a birthright or is it a privilege? Bill C-24 is specifically targeting individuals out of color. Nothing else but color. And it's a very clear-cut picture. And now going so far to even take away citizenship, now going to a next step saying that, oh, if you're born in Canada and your parents are both not citizens, you know that child is not considered a Canadian citizen. And going towards my case, it must have been like a tester case. Let's see what happens with this guy's case, see if he's going to fight back or not. And the question is, now I'm fighting back, but it's a long process instead of new presidents in Canada. What the Canadian government is doing now is specifically targeting individuals and trying to deport them. And it's just a very fascist and it puts people in a very anguished situation. People don't seem to realize that this is how far this judge has gone. The fact that I've been issued two Canadian passports, technically three because I was on my mom's Canadian passport, the Passport Act, it clearly states you can only get a Canadian passport if you are a citizen. Due diligence is done on their side.
Yeah.
three different departments and verify if you're a citizen or not. So that itself is an ownership of saying this person is a citizen. Second is having a birth certificate. Third, that I lived here my whole life. It just goes that the Kenyan government, the Harper government completely disregards it, does not give a damn about people's rights. And if you don't want to uphold the international law, it picks and chooses what rights it wants to uphold and what rights it does not want to uphold. And it's been systematically targeting color since it's been in power. From deportation and onward, immigration has been getting targeted one by one. From 2008 to now 2013, the latest records, look at the difference. A couple thousand people deported, to almost 15,000 people deported last year, including 451 children. Big difference compared to a couple thousand. And then establishing the fact that people are coming to Canada, getting work permits, getting status, and then not able to renew them, getting forced to go underground because they're not able to renew them. Or there's no steps to be regularized, become Canadian citizen, or become permanent resident. There's no program out there right now that a person can become regularized when they come to Canada.
That was Deepen Budlakoti speaking to Dan Keller of the Rabble Podcast Network's AWOL podcast about the recent loss of his appeal of the government's revocation of his Canadian citizenship. And now, ending on a happier note.
When one of our podcasters celebrates, so do we. This year is a milestone year for one of our longest-running podcasts. It's the 10th anniversary of the program Living on Purpose. It hasn't been on the Rabble Podcast Network for all that time, but for most of its decade, it has been a regular feature here at Rabble.ca.
The Rabble Podcast Network itself isn't 10 years old until next year, and we've got to have a huge celebration for that, right, Megan?
You bet. And I'll bet a lot of our listeners don't know that the Rabble Podcast Network was the first curated podcast network in Canada. So lots to celebrate here. Lynn Thompson's podcast began on the radio in Nanaimo in 2004. And it migrated to the Rabble Podcast Network in 2007.
So happy anniversary, Living on Purpose. I spoke to Lynn earlier this month.
Thank you, Victoria. Yeah, what an honor to be one of the longest running podcasts. I would not have anticipated that when I started back in 2007.
For the listeners who maybe haven't heard your podcast, what's the focus and why did you want to bring it over to Rabble?
The show started in 2004. I'd wanted to be on radio a long time, and I had the opportunity to get onto CHLY Campus Community Station in Nanaimo, BC, with a health-oriented talk show. So Living on Purpose seemed to be a really good foundation for a lot of purposeful thought and talking with quite a wide variety of people from different backgrounds and experience, some who had never been on radio before and some who were veterans on the radio, talking about what made their life have meaning and how they were sorting through challenges. So I had the live show on CHLY from 2004 to 2009 with a brief break. But in the meantime, podcasting was very new, and some of my colleagues at CHLY were putting segments from their show on radioforall.net. So I put some on there starting in the spring of 2006. I found out about Rabble Podcast Network because Megan Perry, just around the time she took over the helm of the RPN, she contacted me, and again, I'm trying to figure out how she found me, but she knew about this interview I'd done with a Buddhist swimming coach, and she wanted to put a little segment of that on her podcast on the RPN and wanted some water sounds. So I put together this piece for her and sent it to her. And once that was all done, I asked if I could be a contributor to the Rabble Podcast Network as well. And she said, okay. And she set me up with Wayne McPhail. And Living on Purpose was launched in March 2007 on the RPN. And I originally committed to a contribution Monday and Fridays because I had so much material from the live show. Over the years, I've gone down to once a month just because it became a lot of work.
So then, what would you say to any aspiring podcaster about why they want to do a podcast and think about doing it on the Rabble Podcast Network?
That's a good question. Someone who is new to this whole realm of podcasting, I would recommend that person listens, checks out, explores the Rabble.ca site and the Rabble Podcast Network part of that site, and just see how other people are doing it and to find an angle that would complement everything else. For me, Living on Purpose feels sometimes like a bit of an oasis in the Rabble site because there's such a political bent, which is very necessary and important to have that voice in the media. So I really support that. Thanks so much, Victoria, for this opportunity, and all the best wishes to you, too.
Thank you.
And thank you, Megan, for bringing Living on Purpose online and for all the hard work you did your many years as executive producer of the Rabble Podcast Network.
Oh, thanks for the shout out. It's been great to meet all the podcasters over the years, and Living on Purpose has been a great addition to the site. Many years to come, I hope. Big congratulations to you, Lynn.
And thus ends episode 158 of Rabble Radio, which launched on June 16th, 2005. Time to start planning the 10th anniversary party of the Rabble Podcast Network. And just a reminder that you can hear a few thousand podcasts from the last 9 years on Rabble.ca. Come browse and relive the last decade of our country's progressive history.
Many, many thanks to the podcast contributors included in this episode. That's Dan Keller, John Bonner, and Lynn Thompson. I'm Megan Perry.
And I'm Victoria Fenner. Rabble Radio is a production of Rabble.ca. Thanks for listening.